From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Michael is now a tropical storm bringing heavy rain to southern states already soaked by Florence. A day after Michael slammed into the Florida panhandle as a near Category 5, the third most powerful hurricane to ever hit the U.S. mainland, at least two people have died. FEMA Administrator Brock Long says the coastal village of Mexico Beach took the most direct hit, and officials there say it's unclear if people who refused to evacuate that area may have been killed there. So a grim watch going on there. And it could be weeks before power is back on in the worst hit parts of the state. Here's Brock Long.
It's not just power lines being down. It's transformers that are down. It's substations that have been impacted. And this is not stuff that you just put back together overnight. And it's unrealistic for people to think that it's going to happen within the next day or two in some of these areas.
Joining us from Tallahassee is Lynn Hatter, news director at WFSU. Lynn, Tallahassee, where you are, a little bit inland, but we're hearing that this storm, something that was so shocking about it is how far inland it went. So what's going on in Tallahassee?
Well, about 97% of Leon County, which is where I am, has no power. And if you track a little south, 98% of Wakulla County and 99% of Franklin County and Gadsden are also without power. So, you know, you think about where this storm hit, we are about 60 miles to the east and significant power outages. So this is really a regional event. Yeah. Nobody has power right now in several counties across the Panhandle and the Big Bend.
Yeah. Talk about Mexico Beach. This morning, a Tampa Bay Times crew that got there described fires burning with no one to put them out, cars and trucks stacked like toys, stairs that lead to houses that just aren't there, trees bent over as if trying to run from something. And the aerial footage, I mean, it looks like, you know, recent footage of a tsunami. Entire blocks of homes near the beach washed away. What's filtering back to you about some of these worst hit areas?
Yeah, several, you know, Mexico Beach did sustain the worst hit. We're actually still awaiting word on whether or not they were able to rescue families. Even closer into our area in Apalachicola, if you see the storm surge videos, storm surge up to 9 feet high, you have coastal communities. These are very small coastal communities that are essentially wrecked. Rebuilding them, you know, we don't know how long that's going to take. And I'm actually surprised a crew got in there because we're hearing word of difficulties from other crews trying to get into the area that cannot. Major arteries are still impassable. I-10 is shut down all the way through almost to the Alabama line. So trying to get even out to that area is a challenge right now, and a lot of people can't. And in fact, in Bay County, they're telling people to stay away.
Yeah. The largest hospitals in Panama City are shutting down. Look, what's being said about, I mean, people are just picking themselves up at this point, but the strength of this storm and how quickly it went from a Category 2 to a 4. We've been told in part it's the warming waters. But, you know, what are people there saying? There's no time in history where we can more accurately predict, and yet this came up so fast.
It came up really fast, but what's interesting about this storm is actually the predictions and the forecast for where it was going to hit held relatively true. This was about 2 miles per hour short of making landfall as a Category 5 storm. Its winds were extremely heavy. We were anticipating a Category 3. I woke up Wednesday morning, and they said it was a Cat 4, and I felt my stomach just kind of churn. The most this area has ever sustained is a Category 3. So seeing that storm become a Category 4, an incredibly powerful Category 4, I think there was a National Weather Service called it unprecedented, and we had local emergency management officials telling us that it was the most powerful storm this region has ever seen since 1851, which is before they even gave storms names. So, you know, this was not a regular weather event for the Panhandle.
Look, we were actually coming to visit you in a couple of weeks ahead of the midterms, and we're still going to do that. Looking forward to it. Slightly different reporting, but this comes in this political time. Republican Governor Rick Scott running for a Senate seat against the incumbent Bill Nelson. Tallahassee's Democratic Mayor Andrew Gillum is in a tight race for governor with the Republican Congressman Ron DeSantis. Today, a federal judge rejected a Democratic Party push to extend Florida's voter registration deadline because of Hurricane Michael. But just in the few seconds we have, this hurricane can shape politics depending on how it's handled by the lawmakers.
Storms are political. Gillum came in under heavy criticism for the slow power restoration 2 years ago after Hurricane Hermine. And you actually saw a lot of that sniping going on back and forth, even with this storm. DeSantis was up with ads in several of our panhandle markets, and he's been heavily criticized for not pulling those ads, even as the storm made landfall. And obviously, Bill Nelson is in the area right now, trying to get a spotlight on himself for response. So storms are incredibly political, and this was definitely no exception.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to see you in a little bit, and hopefully the region is picking itself back up. Lynn Hatter, news director at WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, while Michael was making landfall yesterday, the stock market was in a downfall. The Dow fell 832 points yesterday, or 3%. Joining us now is Robin Farzad, who's host of the podcast Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well, but what happened on Wall Street?
Volatility is what happened, and that's historically been a fact of market life, Jeremy. You just can't have the long stretches of risk-taking at any price without these periodic episodes. Indeed, I think since the market set a generation low in March of 2009, we've had 23 corrections of at least 5%. I mean, it's been a spectacular decade, but not without the occasional pullback.
But why all of a sudden like that, to go down 800 points in a day?
I mean, things are priced for perfection. You have the Federal Reserve taking interest rates up still. We hit a level of about 3.25%, which I don't think we've seen for several years. You had all of this back and forth, this sniping about trade wars and an escalation with China. Emerging markets have been swooning. The headline stocks, the fangs, if you will, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, they've been taking it on the chin. And these have been some of the leaders that took the NASDAQ, after all, from 2000 to 8,000. So it's not a perfect world.
Right. Tech is part of why the market has been doing so well. Just three stocks, Amazon, Netflix, and Microsoft, were responsible for 70% of the market's gains. And when you look at what happened yesterday, Apple fell 5%, Amazon down 6%, Netflix down 8%. But if you look at the fundamentals of those companies, they didn't change in 24 hours.
No, but I think what happened with the complacency, you can say that there was a bit too much of the Netflix and chill, as it were, Jeremy. I mean, you look at value stocks, look at emerging markets. They've all been lagging enormously. It's been all about these high flyers, this trillion-dollar club of Apple and Amazon. I mean, there is a world outside of that.
Okay, I want to come back to the Fed and what you said about the Fed. This is an entity that has two mandates. They are supposed to keep unemployment low, and they are supposed to, or do what they can to keep unemployment low and to keep inflation in check. When they announced their latest rate hike, it was met with a yawn. So why would people suddenly be surprised about the Fed raising rates? They've been talking about this for years.
We did hit that tripwire level of about 3.25%. And then you look at the noise emanating from the White House. I mean, this was Donald Trump's appointee, Powell, to run the Fed. Even though, I mean, it's a time-honored tradition to kind of, shake your fist at the Fed when it's tightening into a buoyant economy. If you're Donald Trump, you want to own that economy. And higher borrowing costs are universally unpopular from, homeowners, companies. The midterms are weeks away. And of course, if you're Trump, you're going to shake your fist at higher rates.
And I was listening to a financial journalist speaking yesterday, asked about what President Trump had been saying. He called what the Fed was doing loco. And this person said, don't pay attention to what he's saying. Everybody, every president has the right to get mad at the Fed, but it's not going to influence what they do.
No, the Fed is, like you said, I mean, there's that dual mandate. You're worried about full employment and modest price increases and inflation. When and if the markets start believing that the Fed's finally going to take its foot off the brakes, you're going to see rallies across the planet, I predict. But it's worth remembering that interest rates, while lately they've been higher, they're still historically low, and we're coming off of a period of unprecedented stimulus. The Fed was far higher than when it, where it is now before the financial crisis. I think we were around 5.25%.
How are global markets reacting to what's going on?
there's just disproportionate worry in emerging markets. You look at China. You look at political volatility in Brazil. How are these economies going to keep attracting critical dollars and euros if the Federal Reserve keeps ratcheting up U.S. interest rates? I mean, that is the thing to own, the peerless U.S. Treasury. If the government is offering you, if the central bank here is offering you more for that risk-taking, then why are you going to go abroad and risk it in an emerging market? So those have been getting hit disproportionately.
So, Robin, if you've got investments in your 401k or something like that and you're looking at it today, should you do anything? Should you do anything with your investments?
To my mind, you should be making yourself a sandwich and watching Netflix. Volatility, it's immutable. Seasons change. Sell-offs, they're forgotten. Remember your goals and stay the course and always listen to Here and Now.
That's what they always say. I mean, except for the part about always listen to Here and Now, although that's a good addition to it. But they always say, stay the course, don't sell, 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 even when things are bad.
Yes.
All right. Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure, thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm broadcasting from Southern California today, where homelessness is a growing problem. In this state, there are about 134,000 people without a home on any given night, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We met with a homeless couple in Orange County, a couple from Nigeria, who had fled their country after the terrorist group Boko Haram targeted their family. They and their four children, aged 1 to 14, sought asylum in the U.S. and ended up at a shelter run by a local nonprofit called Pathways of Hope. We're going to use their first names only because they're worried about retribution from people back in Nigeria. We spoke in a small office inside a house owned by Pathways of Hope. Michael is a medical technician, Elizabeth, a nurse. But when they arrived in the U.S., Michael says they had trouble finding work because they couldn't get certified by the state.
So, but when we came, the whole thing was not as fast as we expected it to be. So, and you know, when that happened, we begin to lose courage. Not until when we met a friend who tried to help us within his little resources. From there, we went into an hotel when he couldn't, because he couldn't take us into his apartment due to the policy. So we went to the hotel for a while, and when money ran out, we couldn't afford it anymore. But we just have to gradually, you know, adapt to what we have, because we don't even have the resources to get. So, but sincerely speaking, we haven't given clothes half now, because we have more than enough. You could imagine that we have more than enough through the, you know, the Pathway of Hope, you know, the three stores. We've been there at least on two or three occasions. We've been there to get good clothes. The trousers I'm wearing nice from there.
And yeah, you've got a nice pressed shirt on right now.
I don't think yours is even better than mine.
So no, I don't think so.
What Pathway of Hope has really done for us, and they've given us hope.
Absolutely. They've really given us hope. I must confess, because at a point I was, you know, weeping. I couldn't take it anymore. And my husband was like, we just have to survive. We will survive. He really encouraged me, because I couldn't take it anymore. We have kids. And thank God, these people, I don't know how I can really express it. I'm really getting emotional right now, but they really helped us. They really helped us, yeah. They've given us that hope. We almost lost hope. We're like, are we going to be on the street? Is this how we're going to live our lives? But they gave us the hope. And here we are.
How are your kids doing?
They're doing great. They're really, really doing great. They're all in school now. Thanks to them. They're in school. They gave us the resources, gave us the contacts. They gave us the backing, support letters, and all that. Whatever we need to make sure they're in school and they're well taken care of, you know. They're really doing great, and they are happy and glad. They are so appreciative that they could get a better life.
What would you want people to know about what it means to be homeless today?
Well, it's really hard. It's really hard, I mean, out there. And it's not a good thing to be homeless. It's really, really a very, very bad thing. It's really bad to be homeless, and it's difficult. You are exposed to a lot of harsh conditions. You get hungry, and you don't get any comfort, nothing.
We started our interview with Michael and Elizabeth outside on the porch, but had to move into the shelter's office after tree trimmers started working nearby. Michael said that ability to have peace and quiet is a luxury homeless people don't have.
And I also want to say this, you know, when you came in here, we were about to have an interview outside there, and you said that place was noisy, it was inconvenient. That is one of the indications of being homeless. Those who are homeless doesn't have a place to lay their heads in comfortably. We were not comfortable with the environment outside there. You could wonder who those who will be there permanently. If we don't have this place to come in, what do? We have to use what we have. So most of them that I have there cannot even think straight. Cannot even think straight for themselves. Cannot even think of what can I do to improve my life, because being homeless is like being dead. Edgewise, you are not there. You know, emotionally you are affected. Everything. If you check them, you run out a diagnosis on them, you know that, look, it's not a good thing to be out there. Because the environment is not friendly. Even the police are not friendly.
So what's the plan? What's next for both of you?
Yeah, I think, like I told you, we are professionals and we're sticking to that. We believe that we have a lot to offer. As a medical technologist and as a nurse, we have a lot to offer to the United States. From what I've seen, we have a lot to offer, and all we need is to do what we need to do in terms of getting certified, doing the necessary programming, the necessary examination. The moment we do that and we are able to make it, then I think we are good to go from there. Of course, you know, being homeless, you cannot do that. But I'm happy for the part of what we have taken us in, for us to be able to concentrate and read and study hard, because it's really hard. It's a different thing from what we came with from our country. The practice is absolutely different. So I think that is the way forward, and that is the major way forward for us.
So 6 months from now, if I was to talk to both of you, what will you be doing?
Probably I might be in a hospital setting or a private sector, practicing as RN, I believe, and I pray to God. Amen. And my husband, too, practicing as a medical technologist, as it's been called here. And we having our own permanent housing and being able to give back to the society.
I think also, you know, California is a very wonderful state. I have been authorized to go on and write my professional exams. If I had been in a place like Maryland, I would have been in the hospital setting now. Because all they need is they want to see if you are qualified to practice in the United States, even before taking the exam. And the moment you are qualified to take the exam, you can be absorbed in by any organization. What we call training on the job. So it's easier for you to even pass the exam. But in California, you dare not do that. You cannot do that. You have to pass the exam first. When you pass the exam, then you're going into the practice. So having the authorization to do that, I think I am believing God within the next 6 months you come here, I think we should be able to do well. We don't have a dumb brain. We can assimilate. So I know we can do it, and we will do it.
Let's bring in Jill Replogle, who is a reporter who's been covering homelessness for KPCC here in Pasadena. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Jeremy.
And when you listen there to Michael and Elizabeth, you hear people who are educated. You can't see it, but they're well-dressed. But they're homeless.
Yeah. To me, what their story really illustrates is, you know, what experts say is it's so important to get people housed quickly. You know, the man talked about sort of sinking into that hopelessness. And when people go unhoused for a long time, that just gets worse and worse. And a lot of the things that people complain about street homelessness, you know, they associate things like alcoholism. Mm-hmm. That comes from the trauma of being on the streets for a long time.
How bad is the problem in California right now?
Let me give you an example. You know, up until a few months ago, there were about 200 people sleeping in tents in a plaza right next to the main courthouse in Orange County and next to City Hall in Santa Ana. So, you know, people saw this every day when they walked past. You know, that encampment has since been cleared, but you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who doesn't encounter people pretty much on a daily basis sleeping in parks or asking for money on sidewalks.
And is it getting worse? And if so, why?
The single biggest reason is the lack of housing. I mean, first of all, yes, it's getting worse. The lack of housing in Southern California, and especially the lack of affordable housing. You know, a lot of people haven't yet recovered from the recession, even though that was a while ago now. But rents have risen sharply, and, you know, more people keep moving into the area, and there's just not enough housing for everyone, let alone those whose salaries can't keep up with those market rate rents. And the second big factor is that local governments haven't gotten really serious about addressing homelessness until pretty recently. There's historically been a lot of pushback against shelters and housing for homeless people, and that continues today.
And there's a lawsuit in Orange County currently before a federal judge in California. Tell us briefly about that.
Yet this case came about when Orange County officials sought to clear out a very large homeless encampment, up to possibly 1,500 people, that had been growing for many years along a flood control channel, kind of right smack in the middle of the county. And advocates sued based on a federal legal precedent, which says law enforcement can't ticket people for sleeping outside in public places if there's no realistic alternative for them, if there's not enough shelter space, basically. Orange County officials ended up giving 30-day motel vouchers to about 700 people, and then from there work to get them into shelter and more permanent housing. We don't actually know how successful those efforts were because they haven't really kept track, but the case really forced the county and cities in Orange County to get serious about opening more shelters. There are several new ones expected to come online by the end of the year, and the judge is watching closely.
You've been looking at one particular project, an apartment complex for chronically homeless individuals, but it is controversial. What are people saying about that project?
You know, a lot of the kind of typical concerns, that it's too close to parks and schools, that it will draw more homeless people to the neighborhood. A lot of people are concerned about the idea of knowingly having people with mental health and substance abuse histories as neighbors. Here's what some said at a city council meeting.
I don't want 80 people that need security and mental health services living this close to my neighborhood.
We have enough going on with the homeless that are leaving their needles, their drugs, their messes.
And we are not going to stand by and watch you ruin our neighborhood more and let this come in. We will sue you.
I want to be clear that those sentiments don't necessarily reflect, you know, the whole neighborhood, but loud, angry constituents scare local politicians and, angry people start recall campaigns.
That is Jill Replogle, who is a reporter with KPCC here in Pasadena, who's been covering homelessness. We'll link you to some of her work at our website, hereandnow.org. An important topic. Jill, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And we've been tracking Michael, which made landfall on Wednesday as the third most powerful hurricane to ever hit the U.S., and it's now a tropical storm in the Carolinas, bringing a heavy downpour and the threat of more tornadoes or microbursts like the ones that exploded through Florida. Michael's being blamed for at least two deaths, one each in Florida and Georgia, but some of the hardest hit areas in Florida have not been reached. That number may go up. More than 700,000 homes and businesses are without power. Roads are closed. Dozens of schools are closed, and some had already been closed for weeks because of Florence in the Carolinas. Three rivers are in danger of flooding. Drone videos show almost unimaginable devastation, completely wrecked neighborhoods, roads, and buildings. Here's WDRB Chief Meteorologist Mark Weinberg in Panama City, Florida, describing Michael's impact.
Absolutely incredible damage. And you can see it's not just tree damage. Look at this building, just utterly obliterated. And what I think is the craziest thing is you can see there's actually highway signs where part of this building once was.
Olivia Smith is in Gadsden, Florida. She's the public information officer for the Gadsden County Board of County Commissioners. Olivia, let's get some information out. How are things looking there?
Hi. You know, our county is small, but we're resilient, and we really took a hard hit. The west side of our county was hit pretty hard. What we're doing right now is we're just assessing things and making sure that, first and foremost, our first responders are able to get around safely.
Well, can they? Because we know a big impact of Michael was the downed trees.
Yes, yes. So the downed trees have been a big issue, and our public works crews are working really hard to get those roads clear, and they're also dealing with downed power lines. It's a slow process, but they're working very efficiently, considering some of their own homes have been damaged. So.
Oh, and then they go out anyway.
Yes.
Are you worried about what you might find? You know, we know that the death toll is very, very low, thankfully, at this point, but what's your sense there?
Well, you know, when we move things out of the way and we're clearing up some of the debris, we're just hoping to find nothing more than just damage and no loss of life, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. What are you telling people if many evacuated? How do you communicate with people?
Well, right now, social media is probably the best tool. We're also using a text alert system, and we're also using a system to call landlines. But what we're telling people is to stay in place. There is a mandatory curfew right now until further notice. The issue is that if they get on the roadways and they try to navigate some of these roads, they're going to get stuck. And our first responders, you know, they won't be able to get to them, and their safety is important as well. So we're telling them to stay put and to be patient.
Yeah. It's funny, you're kind of hunkered down there because, you know, there is a curfew. Is there power? Are you able to see television and see some of the pictures from around your region?
We have power because we are on a generator, but our communication systems are still down. The sooner that we get our communications up, we'll be able to tell and to really be able to share our story as we get through this. We're seeing a lot of damage to buildings, but the debris is really, really, really the biggest issue.
Olivia Smith from Gadsden, Florida, where she's public information officer for the Gadsden County Board of County Commissioners. And there is a curfew in effect there, so everybody stay in place. Olivia, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, we're broadcasting from Southern California, one of the places Democrats are hoping to flip some House seats that they'll need to take control of Congress. In Orange County alone, there are four House races ranked as competitive by the Cook Political Report. All of them are currently held by Republicans in this traditionally conservative county, but President Trump's approval rating is low here, creating an opening for Democrats. In the 39th district, Ed Royce is retiring after 25 years in office. The Republican running to replace him is Young Kim, one of his staffers.
I worked in the district throughout the entire 39th congressional district as a congressional staff. This is the community I know. These are the people that I'm running to represent. This is personal to me.
The 39th district is two-thirds non-white. Kim would be the first Korean-American woman ever elected to Congress. But Democrat Gil Cisneros, a Latino and first-time political candidate who bankrolled his campaign with lottery winnings, hopes to turn the district blue.
She wants to protect, I want to protect the border. That's one of the reasons I served the military, was defending our nation. But we don't need to do that by building a $30 billion wall. It's probably going to end up, when it's done, costing $50 billion.
A prominent Republican is also leaving an open seat in California's 49th district, which includes parts of southern Orange County and northern San Diego County. After narrowly winning his last reelection, Daryl Issa is leaving to join the Trump administration as the head of the U.S. Trade and Development Agency. He's endorsed Republican Diane Harkey to replace him.
Well, I'm running for Congress kind of to replace the dysfunction in Washington, D.C. I've worked in the legislature. I've also worked on the State Board of Equalization in very, very minority positions because I'm a Republican in a very, very Democrat state.
Her opponent is Democrat and first-time candidate Mike Levin.
What's happening with the Republican Party and with Trump is that consistent undermining of the Affordable Care Act. And I see it all, my travels throughout this district, I speak with so many people who are one medical emergency away from not being able to pay their rent.
In the other two races, incumbent Republicans are facing tough reelections. In California's 48th district, Dana Rohrabacher is fighting off Democrats who have labeled him Putin's favorite congressman. Rohrabacher has advocated stronger ties with Moscow and once said Putin's muscles were just unbelievable.
Yeah, my constituents want us to work with Russia where we can, and American people want us to work where we can, rather than this unrelenting hostility and push towards putting Russia and the United States in conflict.
Harley Ruda hopes to become the first Democrat ever to win the 48th.
And you know what? We the people are going to not only flip the 48th district, but we are going to wash across this country a blue wave for all of America. Thank you.
And in the 45th district, Republican Mimi Walters is seeking her third term.
I think that the American public has seen what Congress has accomplished. Look at more people today have more money in their pocket. Jobs are being created. We have higher wages.
Walters' opponent, Democrat Katie Porter, touts endorsements from progressive senators Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, her former professor.
We have multinational corporations in this country that before this tax bill were paying zero. And my opponent, Mimi Walters, voted for this tax bill, which is going to fall particularly heavily on families in her own district, in the 45th district in Orange County.
Orange County went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, the first time that a Democrat won the county since FDR. But that doesn't mean it's turning blue for good. Jody Balma is a political science professor at Fullerton College in Orange County.
So two things. First of all, we're still a Republican county. We are becoming less Republican as old white guys die and as the young people are much more diverse. 18-year-olds in Orange County are 50% Latino. So those demographics are shifting. But we went for Clinton because people didn't like Trump, not because Republicans in Orange County suddenly found love for Hillary Clinton.
And what do they think about Trump now?
So a number of people who didn't like him have come around, partially because they didn't have another choice. I think one of the reasons that Republicans in Orange County didn't like Trump was because they didn't like Schwarzenegger. And they had had that experience of an outsider who said that he could clean up the Capitol and didn't understand the government and failed pretty spectacularly in getting what Republicans wanted. So I think it was just that they had had experience that a lot of Republicans across the country hadn't had.
What did Orange County think of President Obama?
So certainly the Republicans didn't like him and spent 8 years hating him pretty vehemently. But it wasn't because they loved Hillary.
So what are Republicans hoping to do in this upcoming election?
So Republicans are hoping to hold on. You know, it's going to come down to three things. It's Trump, it's turnout, and it's taxes. There are a lot of people who are supportive of Trump. And now I guess I've got to add the Kavanaugh factor of driving people to the polls for and against Kavanaugh. But it's all going to come down to turnout. For the Democrats to get all four of those seats, it's going to have to be the perfect wave. And I think the polls are really overestimating the Democrats' chances of getting all four.
What did the Democrats need to do this November?
So the Democrats need to turn out, and they need to turn out in a really big way. I think the story of 2018 might not be the huge victories that the polls are predicting. But I think when we look back, I think 2018 is when the Democrats realized that they needed a farm team. That when you look at the four Democrats that are on the ballot for Congress, not one of them has held elected office before. Not one. The Republicans have all held elected office or are holding elected office. So they've got experience. They've got a ballot designation that people trust. And right now, Orange County, I think almost every single city council is majority Republican. So we haven't seen the Democrats have a big farm team to choose from when they have this opportunity.
It is good to be back in California.
Democrats may not have a farm team, but President Obama feels so confident about their prospects here that he visited last month for a campaign rally. That was before the fight in Washington over the confirmation battle for now Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Outside a shopping center in Huntington Beach, Orange County voter Lori Heed told us she's been trying to oust Republican members of Congress here for years, way before Kavanaugh was in the picture.
My opinion about him is a negative opinion, but he's not influencing my vote. My vote was already my vote prior to him.
Minds may not be changed, but Jody Balma says the Kavanaugh confirmation is likely to motivate Democrats to turn out.
Particularly women who are energized and galvanized. So I think turnout is going to be really hot because of that. I don't know on the other side. I don't know if Republicans who feel like the process was unfair to Kavanaugh, I don't know if they'll be galvanized. I haven't seen that as much.
A recent poll by Berkeley IGS shows Orange County Democrats tied with or beating their Republican opponents, sometimes by wide margins. Although in Orange County, a quarter of all voters have no party preference. Here's Richard LeMaster.
I'm not voting party lines. I'm voting whoever's going to represent the people, not the politicians, not policy, not control, lower taxes. We earn our money. We work for our money. We want to keep our money.
There are also people like Greg Diamond, who doesn't know who represents him in Congress.
I'm going to have to read up on about it before I can really say too much.
Political scientist Jody Balma says many voters may not know the candidates' names.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of party affiliation that they're going to go on.
Do you think that part of that, though, is that things are pretty good in California right now, and you pay more attention to who you're voting for when things are not good than when things are fine? When you're good, when you got a job, you know, yes. You're okay.
Yes. No, I absolutely think that. I think that, you know, part of low voter turnout is satisfaction, that people are not, roaming the streets with pitchforks and trying to get big changes.
Balma says there is one area where many Orange County residents are not satisfied, and that's on the issue of gas prices, which are hovering around $4 a gallon. There's a question on the ballot next month across the state that will ask voters if they want to repeal the state's new gas tax and vehicle fees. Balma says that could awaken Orange County's anti-tax Republican voters and make the road to a House takeover more difficult for Democrats.
India is in the middle of a Me Too moment. Junior Foreign Minister MJ Akbar is the highest-ranking government official to be named in a flurry of sexual harassment or assault allegations against politicians, comedians, journalists, authors, and actors in recent days. The BBC's Geeta Pandey is following the story. She is in Delhi. And Geeta, first, how did this start? Because it seemed to just erupt. I mean, here in the U.S., the Me Too movement was largely launched by women speaking to an investigative journalist. What's happening there?
Well, I think here it actually started with a Bollywood actress, Tanushree Dutta, talking about a case of harassment that she faced about 10 years ago. And she had talked about it at the time, too. And there had been no resolution. In fact, she had said that roles dried up for her and that her career suffered a lot. And then before we knew, there have several women took to the social media to talk about their own cases. And in fact, one of the first ones was a woman who worked in this very popular comedy group. She made very serious allegations against one of the main comedians there. This man, in turn, apologized, and he said that he had behaved badly. So he admitted to it on Twitter. Mm. He put out a series of tweets. And then after that, it's just kind of taken on a life of its own. In the past few days, we've seen several women come out and name all kinds of people, a lot of them actually from the media, from the press.
Well, you know, it sounds as if when you talk about a comedy troupe, it would be as if somebody on Saturday Night Live here in the States accused someone else of sending a photo of their body part, which is what the male comedian was accused of doing. And he admitted to it and apologized there in India. It seems huge. How are people reacting there?
Well, it is quite huge, actually. And I think there is quite a bit of chatter about it. And what's happened, what we've seen in the last few days is that once women started talking about it in Twitter, we've seen really like a flood of Twitter messages from women calling out their alleged harassers. And I think the largest number of people who've been named are kind of journalists, right? So you've had what you spoke about, Mr. MJ Akbar, who is the junior foreign minister in India. And in fact, all the allegations about him pertain to the time when he was editing newspapers, one of the very charismatic editors. And, in the last few days, we've seen at least 7 or 8 women who have come out and with their accounts of harassment. Mr. Akbar has not responded. He is, in fact, according to all reports, he is in Nigeria on official tour, and he's not yet responded to any of the allegations. Journalists have also doorstepped government ministers to get a reaction from them, to get a response from them. And we are still waiting to hear anything from anybody in the government.
doorstepped, gone to their doorsteps to try to get them to respond?
Well, yes. In fact, Mr. Akbar's boss, who's the foreign minister, Sushma Swaraj, she was stopped by journalists as she was leaving a conference. And journalists just stuck their microphones in her face, asking her to respond and also appealing to the sense that she is a woman and she should take a stand on it. Of course, Mrs. Swaraj did not say anything and she's gone off.
Look, we know that at least one newspaper has promised an investigation after journalists accused their senior editor. But you tell us that, you know, this has been sort of whispered, this notion that senior editors were harassing and assaulting reporters, younger women who worked beneath them.
Well, yes, there were whispers all along in the newspapers across India, right? I mean, you know, I've been a journalist for more than 30 years, and I have always heard and, you know, whispers about misconduct by senior editorial colleagues who use their positions of power to proposition and harass younger women. In fact, we've also heard in the last few days, we've heard some really big names who have also been accused of some form of harassment. One of them is a very popular actor, a Bollywood actor from the 80s called Alok Nath. So there are lots of big names that are now sort of starting to come out. Mm. We've talked about it in private meetings for a very, very long time. But this is the first time I can say that, you know, we have actually something like this that's sustained for the last few days.
Mm. Be interesting to see where it goes from here. The BBC's Geeta Pandey in Delhi on their Me Too movement in India. Geeta, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Jeremy Hobson, you are now getting ready to depart Southern California?
Right. We have been here. We've been in Texas and Illinois and Indiana as part of our election road trip, and you're heading to Florida very soon.
Just in time. You know, I actually am glad it was supposed to be a midterm election trip, but we obviously we'll be following up on the devastation from this storm. So
right.
Off we go. Now get home. Hey, Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And we want to thank our hosts here at KPCC in Pasadena, Sean Corey Campbell, Megan Garvey, Jill Replogle, Mary Plummer, Bianca Ramirez, Sal Locurto, and Kristen Muller. Our Southern California stories were produced by Chris Bentley with help from Sam Rafelson and mixed by Mike Moschetto. You're listening to Here and Now.